Golf Smarter number 162 for January 20, 2009.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
A study of classic courses with architect Trip Davis.
This is Golf Smarter. Sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome and thanks for subscribing to and downloading another episode of the Golf Smarter podcast. Yesterday, I attended the press conference for the AT&T Pebble Beach National Pro-Am that will be played over Valentine's Day weekend down in Monterey. And after I recorded the press conference, I got to sit down one-on-one with PGA Tour player Aaron Olberholzer, whose first PGA Tour win was at Pebble Beach in 2006. He's also finished top 10 in two majors during his short career. Now, if you know me by now, that's about as much PGA Tour information that I care to discuss. And my conversation with Aaron was no different. We talked about life on the tour, high school, junior, and college golf, how average golfers put too much pressure on themselves, and a whole lot more. He's a great guy, and that's just a tease. So stay tuned for that interview coming up pretty soon. But today's guest is Trip Davis. Trip joined us in the very beginning of the Golf Smarter podcast back in April of 2006 to discuss the Tribute Old Course. Then we talked about how he designed a course that featured holes from famous British Open venues. Now, I understand that some of you don't find conversations about specific golf courses very interesting because you'll never play there. So when Tripp and I spoke, my goal was to get educated on golf course design and history, not just, let's go play this course someday. So the deal is that Tripp is completing the construction of another 18 holes at the Tribute in Colony, Texas, and this one's called the New Course. As a student of golf course architecture, Tripp joined forces and love of design with Justin Leonard to create the New Course, which features 18 holes that were inspired by the masters of golf course architecture, Donald Ross, Alistair McKenzie, A.W. Tillinghast, and other legends. If you're a fan of great courses and can't travel the world to play them all, then maybe a trip to Dallas, Texas, which is near the colony, may be an adventure you want to schedule sometime. Welcome back to Golf Smarter, Trip.
Hello.
Good to talk to you again. It's been a long time.
It has.
You were one of the first episodes of the Golf Smarter podcast back in April of 2006. And so people don't have to listen to all of it, but we encourage them to. Why don't we talk first about what we originally were talking about was the Tribute, the golf course, the Tribute, the Old Course.
Okay.
Give us an overview of that course.
Well, the Old Course was a project that we did about 10 years ago where we approached the developer after we had been hired about doing a golf course that was unique. And the site we had lent itself to that because it was right on the second largest man-made lake in the state of Texas, and so it had a shoreline. And we threw out the idea of doing a tribute to Scottish Lynx courses, and in the same kind of way that C.B. McDonald did when he built the National Golf Links, you know, not copy holes, but allow them to influence the design and give people a unique perspective of old-style architecture. And so that was the basis for that golf course, and it's done very well. It has continued to outpace the market, and as far as condition goes, it's in better condition today than it's ever been.
No, that's fabulous. And where exactly is the Tribute?
The Tribute is on Lake Louisville, which is about 20 to 25 minutes from downtown Dallas, so to the north.
Okay. Now, one of the things that you said is to utilize or to, I don't want to use the word mimic, but to utilize old-style architecture versus copying holes.
Right.
Tell me what the difference is.
Well, in copying holes, and there have been some developments that have tried to do that, you're trying to recreate exactly what was there. You know, for instance, there's been a lot of golf courses that have tried to copy the, you know, Amen Corner, you know, or various other historical golf holes or stretches of golf holes. And what we did with the Tribute was just to take my favorite holes from Scotland and blend them into an 18-hole routing that worked together. Instead of having 18 separate golf holes, we tried to allow this old style of architecture to blend into one cohesive 18. So in doing that, what we had to do was to take the design and strategic concept of these holes and blend them into the landscape and to the flow of the golf course. So we didn't try to copy exactly the height of a bunker or the shapes of the greens, or we allowed the strategic elements of those holes to influence the design more than anything.
But how in a climate or a topography that is so radically different than you have in England, Scotland, in Texas, mm-hmm. how are you able to create that when, you're not going to have that same kind of feel, I guess, the weather's going to dictate?
Well, the things about links land type golf are that they are typically fairly flat. You know, some of the golf courses over there that are in some of the bigger dunes.
And I guess when you talk about Texas, typically flat could be summed up, huh?
Well, the site we had to work with originally had 2 feet of fall from the north end to the south end over about a 2 mile stretch. So
wow, that's nothing.
It was flat. And so we moved a good bit of dirt just to mimic the roll and the dunes effect. Going as far as trying to, mimic the ecological style of a dune as it comes off the coastline, the way it rolls into the coast. And so that was one element in terms of creating the look. And, more than anything, that's what people remember is the look. The playability element, lends us, the original links courses are very hard and fast, and they're very exposed to the wind. That's another element we had in Texas, especially on this site, because south of the site is Lake Louisville, and there's nothing to block the wind for 10 miles.
Oh.
It's very windy.
So that would be quite similar.
Very similar. Mm-hmm. And then, in order to mimic the ground conditions and the firmness of the ground, we installed a lot of drainage, and we were very cognizant of how we positioned slope so that balls would run out where we wanted them to, and allow you to hit shots into greens that would release as we wanted them to. And then we've also conditioned the superintendent there to keep his water management down so that, keep the amount of water put on the golf course lower than, you might elsewhere. And so it's worked out.
And when you talk about the superintendent, that's really interesting. Is this somebody that had to be familiar with those old-style courses, or you had to take them back there and educate them?
Well, it was more of an education process. We didn't get to make another trip over there to show him.
Unfortunately.
But the main thing was just educating him on what we were looking for from a playability standpoint, and letting him adapt that to Texas, and then we worked together and tweaked it. The first couple of years, the greens were typically too soft, and the fairways were a little softer than we like, and then in year three and year four we got everything tuned in to where for the last 6 years or so it's been as we wanted it to be.
And how's business for that course these days?
Well, I don't get to see the books exactly, but they asked us to do another one, so
then that must be pretty good.
Yeah, that got to be some indication.
Yeah, some testimony there. So when you talk about the playability versus the look, how does that translate to us, to the weekend golfer, to the visiting golfer?
Well, the way that I always the way that I always have found the difference between the two is the look of a golf course is something that the average player is going to pick up on very easily. The playability elements of the golf course, if we do it right, is something that they will appreciate but not exactly know why. It's one of those things that you'll know if it's not there, but you'll not know why it affects you if it is there. The average player is, and we want them to be, more out there for the serenity of the place. We want them to enjoy being out in the environment. And part of that goes to creating a playability that allows them to do that. For instance, if it's too difficult of a golf course, if the playability doesn't match the challenge level it can make it difficult for them to enjoy it. So the style of the golf course, in large measure, can have nothing to do with the playability. But at the end of the day, the playability of the golf course is affected by the style because of how we integrate style into such things as slope, openness to the wind, and so forth.
Interesting. Now, since you have designed courses in the United States and have created a course in the U.S. that is supposed to be a tribute, if you will, to UK golf. What is the difference? I've never played over in the UK. What is the difference for the golfer between United States golf and UK golf?
Well, in general, broadly speaking, the UK has two different styles of golf courses. Very generally speaking, they have the links style golf courses, and then they have inland courses. Inland courses can also play hard and fast. Heathland-style golf courses in the UK are very similar to links courses in that they're usually on sand, usually exposed to the wind, but they don't have the relationship to the sea like the links courses do. The biggest difference that an American golfer would notice in going over there versus playing here is the condition of the golf courses. Golf courses over there are not maintained near to the level that the perception of quality is here. We call that a lot of times the Augusta National effect, and that in the United States, everything is manicured to the extreme. In the UK, they're more concerned about playability and strategy and keeping the golf course in a condition that allows the golf course to play the way you wanted it to. And that's the connect that architects and superintendents and developers need to have in the U.S. Is the look of the golf course and how it's intended to play. And in the U.K., you'll find golf courses that the sole purpose is to make sure that they play the way they're intended to be played. In the U.S., there's more of an emphasis on making them look good.
And do you have a preference on the style of course that you'd prefer to design?
Well, I'm one of your more strategic style type of architects in that I center design a lot around playability and strategy. And so I tend to try to influence, and we spend a lot of time in the process of planning and design with our clients, getting them to understand how playability can be affected by maintenance and style, and get them to understand that the playability of the golf course, whether it's a challenge or its openness so that the average player can enjoy playing it while still having some strategic elements involved, needs to be central to the design, and that the pretty side of the golf course can be integrated into that. And that's the challenge in the U.S. versus the U.K. is that, there's a greater concern here over style versus substance.
I'm not sure if you're positioning yourself or making an argument here, but it sounds as if you're saying that you're maybe, if I can use the word, maverick or a rogue in that sense of architecture these days.
Well, I think it's a. I think we're seeing a lot of golf course architects and developers trend that way, and I don't really do it to position myself or to, to create a niche or anything along that line. Other than it's just the way that I think golf should be played, and we should create the experience for the golfer. Mm-hmm. But you're seeing a lot of people move that way as they realize that, when we went through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, style was much more important than substance. Developers were trying to sell backyards, and they still are to a large extent when we are doing real estate developments today, so you have to be cognizant of that. But they're starting to understand that if the golf course doesn't have substance, if it doesn't allow them to enjoy the playing of the game, you're missing out on the element that contributes to the longevity of the facility. You know, you're only going to sell that backyard once initially. The developer's really only concerned about selling it once. And after that, for the golf course to sustain itself, it's got to be enjoyable to play. And that's what I think a lot more people are focusing on these days.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting that, you term it as backyards, and you see all these homes that are being developed. And you're right. In those decades, it seemed to be a lot of developments that had a golf course versus the other way around. The golf industry is clearly, we've talked about this on the program multiple times, the golf industry is having some real issues with, I guess the three biggest factors would be it's too expensive, it takes too long, and the game is too hard. What about the issues of golf course architecture today? What do you see as the big issues that you're facing?
Well, I think, you know, the environmental elements that exist, there's a lot of people that will suggest that those are extremely limiting, and I don't really see that as much. There's definitely more regulation that we have to deal with in certain areas, but I don't find it limiting. Which is one thing that, you know, that's out there is that, you know, golf course design is challenged by environmental issues, and I think you have to just integrate them into your design instead of looking at them as limiting. The marketplace has become very difficult here recently, especially in the U.S., because the real estate side of things is a challenge. So we're seeing, you know, whereas 4 or 5 years ago, every new course we were doing had a residential element to it. Now that's not as prevalent, and at the same time, the public golf market is experiencing the same difficulties. And so, really, the U.S. golf market, as far as development goes, has come to almost a halt. And so, that's, you know, obviously a challenge. We've actually had to go. We have a project in Acapulco, Mexico, and we have one in England right now, trying to broaden things out to find work elsewhere. So,
what about in Asia?
You know, I've been approached about doing work over there, and I have a family that I enjoy spending time with, and I'd rather take on less work and just make it through. Then go over there. I think it's just. I also have I'm the type of architect who really gets involved in the field, and I like to be on site 2 or 3 days a week, and that would be impossible if you're working over there because of the travel time.
Sure, of course. When you say the public golf market, are you talking about public courses versus private courses?
Yes, and you know the private market in the U.S. right now. is at the high end is doing okay in a lot of ways.
It's just not affected. The financial issues for that level of lifestyle,
right.
It's just not affected, huh?
Not as much. And,
sure.
But, you know, as you get towards the I wouldn't necessarily call it more affordable, but just more reasonable is probably a better word. They're having troubles because their members are not spending as much, and they're losing members, and they're not having people on the waiting list like they used to.
Sure.
The public market is just experiencing, you know, people with a lack of disposable income, you know, people like me who have families that, you know, we're chasing soccer teams around instead of golf balls.
Thank you for not saying hockey pucks.
Yeah. Well, in Oklahoma, it's soccer balls. So.
Yeah, right. Right.
Or footballs, but I got two girls, so we're not
soccer.
Going there.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a challenge right now, and you know we're making it through primarily because we have a reputation for doing restoration renovation work, and that's my market that's still necessary. Because if you're going to keep a golf course, you have to understand that it's an evolving, living, breathing creature, and you have to take care of it, which involves renovation and restoration in a lot of cases.
What's the difference between, from your perspective, from the architect's perspective, what's the difference between a public course and a private course in its strategic design?
Well, strategically, you know, it just depends a lot on exactly what you're designing for. But, you know, I've come to the conclusion that there really shouldn't be any. If you go back and you look at a lot of the older golf courses that we built back at the turn of the century.
Which century are you talking about?
Well, yeah.
you mean back
let's say between 1900 and 1930.
Okay.
Those golf courses were built to allow multiple ways to play a hole, and they very much took into consideration the average player and their ability to advance the ball. And one of the things that happened, you know, going back to the style approach, we started putting in lakes because they're pretty. You know, we started building deep, deep bunkers. Residential development started narrowing corridors for golf holes up, so the holes became tighter, so we couldn't broaden out the strategy quite as much. And I've actually found on a couple of public projects that we've done over the last few years where I had more flexibility to create a strategically interesting and varied game than I did with our residential projects where our corridor was limited. And so strategically, you know, from a pure strategic standpoint, there doesn't have to be a difference between the two.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, that kind of leads us to the reason why we're getting together today. And down at in the Colony, Texas, where you did the old course of the Tribute, you've got a new project that's about to open up, and it's the new course. And this is part of another type of Tribute, correct?
It is. It's when we did the first course, there was always the anticipation of doing the second course. You know, speaking of environmental issues, if we would have not planned the second course when we did the first course, we probably wouldn't have gotten it built because we were able to basically grandfather in the site plan into today's environment. But when we always had the idea that we were going to do an old-style golf course. You know, we were going to do a course that was a tribute to Scottish Links courses, and then the second course would be a tribute to what happened when the game came to America. So early American architecture, that same period we were discussing a minute ago, between 1900 and 1930. Or you could even extend that to 1940, really. But so that's, you know, that's been on the drawing boards for over 10 years now. And the style, their intent really didn't evolve much. It was we stuck to building a golf course that was a tribute to early American courses. Now, one of the things that we realized that was going to be more of a challenge with early American courses versus just sticking to links courses from Scotland is the varied amount of topography. The vegetation types and so forth, the varied degrees of playability. And trying to look at it from the perspective of, like, my favorite holes from early American architecture and allowing them to influence the design was more of a challenge. And so we concluded that it needed to be more of a play on the style of early American design, which was really very similar to the Lynx courses. With the difference in that, when you came to the U.S., you were dealing more with more often with more radical terrain, so had a lot more up and down. You had a lot more elevation change, and you typically were dealing with more vegetation, trees, and so forth. And we saw that as a possibility because the site we had for the second course had a lot more elevation change, had a lot more mature trees to it, and so that's how we integrated. The concept for the second course was more of a stylistic approach. Now, when we got into the process of designing this second course is going to have some homes next to it. They're on the periphery. They didn't influence corridor widths or anything to that extent, and they're really only on about five holes. And but anyway, they got Justin Leonard. They asked me to think about bringing in a recognized name from the playing world. And Justin and I have been friends for a long time, and And he has as great an appreciation for that old style of architecture as I do. And so we got him involved, and he was very active in helping with, thinking about the different styles of design, the different types of playability we would incorporate.
How would a golfer today recognize that you've utilized, you know, especially if they've not played a course by some of the people that you're trying to emulate, let's use that word, how would a golfer who's out there who just likes to go and hit the ball and get to his ball and hit the ball and, you know, it doesn't really notice golf course architecture, but they're coming to play this golf course and there's just great elements. What are they looking for? And strategically, how can they utilize that?
Well, what we did with the new courses is, as I mentioned, you know, the early American golf courses were much broader in terms of this type of strategy they allowed players to play. There wasn't a single element of how you could, or a single way to play a hole. You know, for instance, you know, when you look at a lot of golf courses that were designed over the last 30 years in the U.S., in a modernistic approach, if you read the strategy guide, for instance, it'll say, stay down the left side of this hole so you have a better look at the green. Well, if you go play National Golf Links, for instance, up on Long Island, that was done in between 1907 and 1910, you couldn't find that. It'll say, if the pin is on the right side of the green or if the wind's coming from this direction, you know, you'd want to be here or there or there. And so the golf course is broader. And what we did, what Justin and I incorporated with the new course was to create very large fairways with different types of elements that would suggest where you needed to hit the ball. Instead of having, you know, a bunker at the corner, we would have a lot of bunkers in different places that would allow you to play to different angles. And so what, you know, the average player is going to find when they play the new course is the ability, the first time they play it, they're going to think, well, God can hit it anywhere. And as they learn to play the course and playing it over and over again, they're going to realize that I can hit it over here, but it's going to give me a more challenging approach to that pin when it's on the left side of the green. So I want to try to play more down this side. And we've kept everything open in front of them, and so that there's nothing hidden about it. But it's a golf course that we hope is going to inspire the player to want to understand strategic elements and want to improve their game to control their ball a little better so that they can play the game more strategically.
There are definitely courses that I've played that I feel like I want to play this again and again and again because you get a greater appreciation each time you play it, and you learn different ways of playing it. You know, you start thinking of, okay, I'm not just going to hit the ball as far as I can here. I need to put it there. Mm-hmm. Who are your inspirations on the various holes of the new course of the Tribute?
Well, from an architectural standpoint, we took a lot from Perry Maxwell, who was more of a Midwest guy, but did a lot of renovation in the Northeast. He did a lot of work in tweaking Pine Valley. The Augusta National we know today, you know, prior to the last few years, was more Maxwell than it was McKenzie. So his approach to using slopes to impact angles, for instance, because you can have basically a square green, and if you have the right type of slope in it, it definitely influences the way you can play the hole. And he was a master at that, so he was definitely a strong influence. And we took a lot from not necessarily specific holes, but the way he implemented strategy and incorporated that. You know, for instance, setting a green to where you want to hit a, you know, you want to be able to have the ball move left to right, but have the fairway tilted right to left, so that, you know, you've got a hook lie trying to play a cut shot. Those are the kind of things that he did a lot of. Donald Ross was very good at positioning features on a golf course so that they impacted strategy, both slopes and bunkers, and the way he positioned greens. If we came close to copying anything, our 14th hole is a par 5 that has a green that's very similar to the 10th hole at Pinehurst, for instance. The way he elevated the green, requires you to play shots that both use slope in the green and control your distance so that you could approach the green real well. And so he was an impact. Tillinghast, who did Wingfoot and a number of other places, his flair for style was both bunkering and how that related to strategy was a huge impact on us when we did the project. You know, the specific golf courses that probably had more of an influence stylistically, Maidstone up on Long Island, Pine Valley, National Golf Links, Chicago Golf Club, for instance, were all courses that we had kind of, you know, when we were doing design and even as we were moving through construction, we had an image gallery that everybody had, you know, access to, and we interjected it regularly so that they kind of got the clue. So it was, there was a lot of influence, both strategically and stylistically from those guys and those courses.
And how, I mean, you only had 18 holes to work with. How did you determine it's like, wait, we need to get something in from this course, or we need to get this architect in? I mean, how did you, you know, edit yourself to narrow it down to 18 holes?
Well, we basically just, we allowed the influences to come out instead of trying to interject them. And, you know, instead of trying to force anything, as we were working through the routing and as we were working through grading plans and as we were working through construction, we allowed things to pop in our mind. You know, and Justin and I took time to go play a lot of these golf courses, and we spent a lot of time talking about them. And so when we came across it, either in design or during construction, it was something that we would, it just kind of came to us. You know, it would pop out as, you know, here's a great place to use something we saw. And instead of trying to force it, we didn't say, you know, here's something that we'd like to incorporate somewhere. Let's find a place to do it. It was more we reacted to it as it came to us. So we didn't really have, you know, 100 different elements that we tried to squeeze into 18 different holes. It was more, let's create an interesting flow to the golf course from a routing standpoint, and then let's let things that we've come across influence how we react to those things that we come across in the field.
Well, it sounds like you've created a phenomenal destination area of golf. You got those two courses there now. Was that the intent all along, is to create a destination?
It was. Jack Matthews, who is kind of the brain trust behind it all, and another gentleman named Ken James, who is not involved with the project anymore but was, you know, heavily influential initially, saw this as an opportunity to do something that, you know, Mr. Matthew saw it more as a, if you guys pull this off, I've got something I can sell here in a lot of different ways, you know, whether it be resort, hotel, office, commercial, and home sites, you know, within a community. The thing that he allowed us to do that was which is what I think has helped us pull this off, is he didn't force any of those other elements into what we were planning. He allowed them to surround it and be integrated into a community instead of saying, you know, you've got to bring the golf course up in here, so I've got homes and office and hotel surrounding every hole you've got out there. So that was integral. He saw the fact that if we created great golf that people would enjoy playing, he could surround it with things instead of forcing us to integrate them into it. So that was one of the key ingredients to the success of the course. And then, but you know, in large measure, we always saw that we had unique pieces of property because even though the first site we had didn't have any fall to it at all, it was on a lake, and we had the ability to move dirt to create something unique. And then with the second course, we really didn't move much dirt at all because it was already there. And, you know, I think golf courses in large measure are successful. Almost 9 out of 10 of the reasons because of where they are and the site and the environment that's already there. And all we can do is tweak it to improve it.
And it also sounds like you have created a situation for the local golfers where they're going to want to continue to come back because of the strategic play that's designed into both courses.
Yeah, and that's the thing that has been gratifying to me with the first course, and we certainly hope occurs with the second course, is you know, people that I've talked to, or you know, people that the staff down there talks to, the reason they come back is because every time they play it, it's different. And you know, a lot of that has to do with some of it has to do with design. A lot of it has to do with the environment, and that you know, the wind never blows out of the same direction, and it's different out there every day. And what we try to do is to create a golf course that could adapt to all those changes, and give them an experience that each day is going to be different. And I think that's the most important part about golf course design, is to try to create variety, so that whether it's a private club, a public club, a resort course, whatever it may be, every time you play it, it throws something different at you, so that not only do you experience something different, you feel compelled to come back and learn from it.
That's amazing. That's awesome. Well, we have a large audience in the Texas area, and if you are around Dallas and you've had a chance to play the Colony, down in the Colony at the Tribute, either the old course, and the new course opens now? It's already open?
No, it's right now we've still got a little bit of grassing to do in the spring, and we're set for probably early September of 09 opening. But you know, if you're down in the area, you're as long as you don't drive your car out there, you're more than welcome to take a look around. And so it's definitely worth even just taking a walk around.
Well, it sure would be a lot of fun if we had our very first Golf Smarter golf gathering out there, and in September or October of 09.
Well, that would be kind of apropos, since I was your first architect on, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be a lot of fun. We can get a lot of people to gather down in Texas to go play golf on both courses. That would be a trip.
Yeah.
No pun intended. Tripp Davis of Tripp Davis and Associates, architect, thank you so much, and best of luck with the Tribute, both the old course, which is open, and the new course, which will be open in September of 09. We wish you the best of luck, and we really appreciate you coming back on the show.
Thank you.
If you're a member of the Golf Smarter group at Facebook.com, I've received a lot of feedback on my last question about what kind of guests you like to hear on this show. I find this really helpful, and your comments are still encouraged. But if you read what others have written, you can see that there's not a consensus. So, as always, I'll do my best to keep the content varied. I bring this up because a question was posed today by Pete Makepeace, who lives near Birmingham, England. Pete's interested to know if anyone's using any of the apps available on the iPhone, the 3G iPhone that provides golf GPS services. He says, quote, "I know that there are quite a few. Some are cheap, some are expensive, and some seem to do more than others. So I'd really appreciate benefiting from other people's experiences." That's going on right now at Facebook.com, and we'd love your input. Hey, don't know if you heard the great news, but Dean Thompson, the PGA Tour instructor who's the inventor of the perfect putting machine, has agreed to give another one of his great putting aids away to a Golf Smarter listener. Deadline for entry is Friday, January 31st, 2009. I got an email from somebody last week saying, yeah, you didn't put that up yet, so thanks for reminding me, but you can enter if you missed it last week. You still have till January 31st, 2009 to enter to win the perfect putting machine. You can hear the entire conversation with Dean on putting, putters, and his perfect putting machine on the episode dated December 2nd, 2008. Now, if you've never entered one of our contests before, please go to golfsmarter.com and click on contest. Right now, these promotional giveaways are what's keeping this podcast afloat. In any way that we can show how much support the Golf Smarter community provides our partners will really help in the future. For more information about the perfect putting machine, click on the ad at the top of the contest page at golfsmarter.com. And if you purchase your very own perfect putting machine, make sure that you use the Golf Smarter checkout code to receive a free carrying case. In honor of the inauguration of President Barack Obama, we close with a quote and a warning from former California Governor George Duke Machen. The difference between golf and government is that in golf, you can't improve your lie. Next week, Mental Power Golf with Sports Mind Coach Stephen Latham via Skype from Australia. If you have any quotes, comments, suggestions, or questions, you can send me an email by clicking on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.